more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we met a director whose latest film is an autobiographical telling of his childhood in wartime Poland. Filmmaker Ruben Mamoulian left his native Armenia before the war in an effort to escape looming strife. He fled to France and England, where he made theater connections before coming to the U.S. to work at the Eastman School of Music. He went on to a career that was innovative in its technical prowess and for its content, such as when he hired an all-black cast for Porgy and Bess. Throughout his career, he was outspoken and clashed with producers and other studio executives in Hollywood. A new biography by Milwaukee writer Dave Lurson makes the case that Mamoulian is the most important filmmaker you've never heard of. Lurson tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon more about the filmmaker.
Well, he directed the premiere on Broadway of Porgy and Bess, Oklahoma, Carousel, Lost in the Stars, and not only did he simply direct these plays, he had a lot to do with shaping, editing, and not exactly composing them, but the form in which we know them, in which we know these musicals, has a lot to do with his creative input. In Hollywood, and this was very unusual in those days to have this bi-coastal Hollywood Broadway career, he directed Mark of Zorro and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Queen Christina, which are notable classic films, but he was a great innovator in terms of the technology of cinema. One of the most important things he did right at in the early days of talking pictures, if you've ever seen many of these sort of 1929, 1928 talking movies, they are very odd things to watch. They're very static. The sound cameras, the earliest generation of them, were these huge, noisy things enclosed in the wall so that the noise of the grinding machinery didn't bleed into the soundtrack. So you had a stationary camera basically pointed at a set with one microphone in the middle of it, where people kind of talking at the microphone in the middle of the set. Mamoulian thought this was absolutely ridiculous. He had a distinct aesthetic sense for what filmmaking ought to be. He had a very simple solution to the static camera thing. He put this gigantic sound camera on wheels and had a crew of people moving the thing literally from point to point around the soundstage so that motion was restored to motion pictures. And he placed several microphones in the set at the same time, which some people thought would be technically impossible to have more than one microphone. How can you have more than one microphone? But he said, ridiculous, we can do it, and multi-tracking was born.
Not only were there multiple mics, but as you just said, multi-tracking now, or what era are we talking about?
1929.
Was multi-tracking used? I mean, I should know the answer to this, of course, but was that used in radio, for example, or sound productions that aired on radio, or is it just new to film?
It was certainly new to film, and I can't really answer your question about radio. I have a feeling that radio broadcasting was still in kind of a primitive state at that time, but it was certainly the first time anyone had tried this in film. It seems like a very obvious thing to do, and nobody had thought of it. Another very obvious thing that Mamoulian did as an innovator was the voiceover. In his one of his next movies, a gangster picture, there was a voiceover in this movie, and the producers of the movie said, you can't have a voiceover. Nobody's going to know where that voice is coming from. And again, he said, ridiculous. Of course people will figure it out, and they did, and hence the voiceover was born. Now, some of these things were such, you know, simple ideas that somebody else would eventually have come up with them. But the point about Mamoulian was that he was the person who was always thinking just around the corner. And he beat the competition in a lot of these areas.
The list of movies that you just mentioned was quite impressive. I mean, these are all movies that I think that we know, musicals.
Right.
So, but before that, he was in theater. He was brought over to the U.S., if you will, by Kodak.
Right? George Eastman, the eccentric camera tycoon.
Right.
I may even have called him that in the book.
Okay. I mean, so he was in London. He was actually from Armenia. Then he went to London, well, Paris, and then London, or London, then Paris, and then he was in New York. And that's where he basically got started, was at
Eastman School of Music and Drama.
Okay.
It was a remarkable ascent, really, for an unknown emigre from the recently collapsed Russian Empire. But Mamoulian was always very ambitious and willing to seize opportunities. Rochester, New York, where the whole Eastman School was a stepping stone in Mamoulian's mind, I think, from the beginning to New York, which is where he wanted to do theater. That was the focal point of theater in America and much of the world at that time. And he broke into that very quickly and did a number of extremely interesting and innovative stage productions, including world premieres of Eugene O'Neill plays and American premieres of things like RUR, a European science fiction drama in which the word robot was first coined. So he even did science fiction on stage. The only thing that Mamoulian never did on stage or film was a Western. There are no Mamoulian Westerns out there for some reason, but he had his hand in just about everything else.
Well, I find it interesting that you say that he was ambitious, and it sounds like he clearly was, but it wasn't just that. You hear stories about immigrants of the past who were ambitious, but he was that, but he also, it seems, he didn't just do anything. I mean, he didn't do anything to get ahead.
Right.
He really picked and chose what he wanted to do.
Well, he had a very well-defined aesthetic sense about theater and film, which he saw as being very distinct art forms. He did not think that film should be, theater with cameras in front of it. I mean, he had a different concept of what movies ought to be. And this aesthetic sense comes out of Stanislavski in many ways. He studied at the Stanislavski School in Moscow during World War I. And he came, I think part of understanding him was that he came from a prosperous, well-established family. And I think he always went through life with the sense, even at times when he didn't have any money at his disposal, that, I am privileged. I don't have to get down on my knees. I'm here. I want to do things, and I will do them the way I think they should be done because I am an artist, and I don't really want to listen to some Philistine, producer telling me that voiceovers are impossible. On the other hand, though, he was not an elitist in this kind of attitude because Mamoulian thought it was very important to have an audience. He was not kind of a stereotype avant-garde person who, thought that if you had more than three people watching your movie that this was a bad thing. He wanted to reach a large audience, but he wanted to do it in a way that was artistically pleasing to him, that had his sense of integrity, and yet was open enough that a lot of people could understand what he was trying to do.
But it's also this distinctness, you call it, that seems like it got him in trouble quite a few times. Yeah.
He was always in trouble, it seems, with producers over one thing or another, and he got away with it as long as he sold a lot of tickets. I mean, it's an old Hollywood story, an old Broadway story, too. We put up with the eccentric genius type as long as they draw the crowds. But when they stop doing that, then we're not going to cut him as much slack anymore. And that was partly what happened to him. I mean, his career after the mid-1940s really diminished in Hollywood. He made very few movies after the middle of that decade. His theater career kept going on to around 1950 and then became very spotty after that point. Another factor, though, in addition to what we're talking about here with people saying, well, he didn't, his last picture didn't sell. Well, there was that. But also he married into one of America's wealthiest families. And I think that relieved a certain whatever financial pressure he may have had to engage Philistine producers with his ideas. He didn't feel he needed to do this anymore. Why bother with this? I have a great track record behind me. I can sit back and simply do projects that come to me that are interesting. And maybe unfortunately for him, not that many opportunities came. He did Silk Stockings with Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse was his last successful movie, late 1950s, a great kind of end of the musical era film. And then he was hired to do Cleopatra. And this movie was one of the great money losers of all time. He was probably lucky to have been fired from this thing early on because really, in my research into this, the problems with this film had little to do with him but lots to do with everyone else around him. And he thought it was ridiculous to try to film a movie set in Egypt, in London, in November, when you can see the breath coming out of the mouths of the cast shivering in their fake Egyptian costumes. So it was just a nightmare for him. He got booted from it. And that was the last time he ever worked on film.
How old was he by that time?
Well, he must have been in his 60s by then. He lived to be quite old, around 90 years old, died in 1987.
Well, that makes it sound like, well, he was booted from the profession, but, I mean, he was old enough. I mean, he had a really respectable career before that. So, it's not like he was just, you know, put out to pasture. I mean, he really did some great things.
The industry put him out to pasture, but he had a kind of a second wind touring film festivals that were, you know, film festivals were a growing thing already in the 1960s. Film departments were being established at many universities, and Mamoulian was this great person to have at your film festival or on a panel discussion because he was very lucid, very erudite, very personable, and could tell you stories about the origins of talking film and many other technical developments. So he made a great splash doing that. There were retrospectives of his films at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and so on. And you know, he enjoyed this very nice afterglow career, you know, through the end of his life.
I just want to talk about some of his innovations. We talked about a few of his audio techniques. He was also very pro African American, or having all African American casts at a time when that was really really pushing the limit.
Mm-hmm.
Porgy and Bess was one of them.
Yes, Porgy and Bess, and even things before that time, the 1920s, where it was even more difficult to do. Even though he came from a prosperous family, as an Armenian, he was very much aware of being part of a persecuted minority group. And he brought that sensibility with him to the New World. He thought America was a great place of opportunity, but he wasn't blind to the problems that he saw in American society, where there were, you know, ethnic minority groups who were, you know, kept underfoot, not allowed the opportunities that other groups were, in fact, violently persecuted in terms of lynching and so on in the South. So he had a great sympathy for African Americans and a great interest in African-American music and culture. He equated much of it in some way with his Armenian heritage, and he was always very anxious to try to push the limit in Black participation in film and theater.
Well, what is it that we should take away about Mamoulian at this point? And maybe give us three movies that are the best examples if we want to go check some of these out.
Well, I think Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Queen Christina, where he had to develop camera lenses and techniques to get that finale scene with her going off into the distance. That was deemed impossible to film at that time, too, when he did it. And Mark of Zorro, I mean, which is a tremendously influential film in popular culture. All of those films were groundbreaking in some respect, and yet were conceived to draw in the maximum possible audiences for groundbreaking films that often snuck interesting, if you want to say, subversive ideas into the mix. So he was a person of artistic integrity who wanted to have an audience. And I think that this is something that independent filmmakers of today should keep in mind. I mean, he worked, you know, all of his life in Hollywood for studios, but he was always at the edge of the system, always trying to do as much as he could in spite of the obstacles being put in his way. You could kind of call him almost a quasi-indie filmmaker if you wanted to stretch the definition. But he wasn't content with simply, like, you know, opening a movie somewhere in at a festival in Idaho and 100 people see it. He wanted to be big on his own terms. And I think this can be an inspiring model for filmmakers today.
Okay. Congratulations on your latest book, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is the author of the biography Mamoulian: Life on Stage and Screen, published by the University of Kentucky Press. He's also arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express newspaper and our regular film contributor. He spoke with Dan Harmon. Lurson will talk about his book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. We'll move on to something completely different after a break. In fact, so different we should just wait until after the break to tell you about it. This is Lake Effect on WUWM.